Good morning, everybody. I am very happy to be here today. There's nowhere else that I would rather be on a day when the world is so troubled, and we can come here and be together to steady our hearts, to connect with one another, to continue these practices of seeing things as clearly as we can. And I also want to welcome Sylvia. Sylvia's joining us for a little while today. So how lucky we are. So we both thought it would be wonderful to continue our teaching together this morning that we've been doing for the last few weeks. So really glad that you're here. I am joining you from the ancestral land of the Wiat, which is about 300 miles north of San Francisco on the coast in the Redwoods, the town of McKinleyville. And it's just a pleasure to be here. And I'm wondering if there's anybody who is here today for the first time. Just let us know, wave your hand. Kate, welcome to you. Do you want to unmute and tell us where you're joining us from?
I'm joining you from a little outside of Detroit, Michigan, and really serendipitously signed up for this, and it comes just at the right time. Thank you for your opening words, and thank you for being here, everyone.
Yeah, thank you for joining us, Kate. Somehow we do end up oftentimes exactly where we need to be. Somehow that happens. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else joining Spirit Rock for the first time today? Okay, well, welcome, welcome. There are some of you I haven't seen in a long time. It's really lovely to see you again. Some are a little bit of a surprise, so happy to see you. Oh, so let's just start by looking at each other. This is such a beautiful way to begin. And if you can turn your video on, please do for the next minute or so. And I understand if you can't, I know that that happens. But just take a look at each other's faces and maybe even sense each other's hearts. We show up over and over again. Because that's the dedication to love, is to show up over and over again. This is what we do. Just notice how that feels in your body to connect with one another just by seeing each other. Thank you for doing that. And I certainly appreciate the invitation from Carlita to keep your settings on gallery view, because we are all in the room together. We are all guests in each other's homes or wherever we're calling from. And I like doing that because I feel like I really am in the room with everybody. And of course, switch the setting if you need to, but I love this. I love looking at everybody. So how our morning will go is that we will begin very shortly with an arriving meditation, and then we'll talk with each other a little bit, offer some little bit of some Dharma thoughts, and then we'll have a meditation later in the morning, and we'll just see what needs to be said today and how we want to talk about how do we integrate our practice with the incredible suffering that is in the world. And not that that's new, not that that is a new intention, but it's really important today, isn't it? It's really, really what we need to do. So let's begin and arrive. And please find a posture in your body that feels most natural to you. No forcing. Letting the body actually find its own posture. You may be sitting, you may be reclining, you may be standing. Welcoming your whole self, mind, heart, body, into this time, exactly as you are. You can close your eyes if you feel like it. If you don't, just have a gentle, soft gaze down. sensing the places where the body is both touching itself and also touching the furniture or the floor. Giving over the weight of the body to the support that's beneath you. Breathe and know you're breathing. Nothing special to do. Being here, arriving here. Holding just enough energy in the back of the body to stay attentive. And also relaxing the whole front of the body so there's space. Space to breathe, space to be. Let's sit quietly. If you're noticing any predominant sensations or emotions, just letting them be as they are. You don't have to figure it out. You don't have to change it. Welcoming, even inviting every aspect of whatever is happening in the mind and in the heart and the body to show itself, because this is what's here. We meet ourselves with kindness, with openness, with friendliness, exactly as we are. This is a poem from Alfred Lamotte called Gentle. A gentler world begins in the way you touch your heart. Be soft with the light inside you. Caress your body with this breath. God is nothing else but the place where the sun comes up in your chest. You are the gleaming, glimmering destination. You are the golden honey daubed on the bread of the ordinary. Whatever is perfect, whatever is heavenly, begins here. Good morning. Coming back. I've been thinking a lot about what would be helpful today. What's a way for us to be together, and what would be helpful to talk about given war, given the unimaginable suffering that we just need to name? You know, it's here and we all know it. And my hunch is we all feel it. I do. So last time I was here, we had a long conversation about the first two foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body, and the second foundation, mindfulness of what is pleasant and unpleasant, difficult and easy, pleasant, you know, comfortable, uncomfortable, vedana. And through the presence of the body, through the awareness that we cultivate of what is here in the body, how does difficulty or maybe even unknown, uncomfortable sensation in the body, how does that condition the mind when something is somewhere on that unpleasant range? What kind of thoughts are formed, and then how do we act out of those thoughts? And the question that we studied a lot and talked together a lot about was the how do we take bodily sensations and reactions off the cushion out into everyday life in a skillful way? And the second question was, when we show up with care, but we're met with ill will, what do we do about that? So we had a long conversation about that and talked a lot about the next part that we want to talk about today, which is intention. Why am I doing what I'm doing? Why am I here? What is my motivation? And sometimes these things are unnameable. Sometimes the sensation in the body or the reaction that they may cause could surprise us, because sometimes painful experiences cause very painful actions, as we're seeing. And it can be really hard to answer those questions. How do I take the bodily sensations and reactions off the cushion into the world in a skillful way? How do I manage meeting when I think my intention is to show up with kindness, with love, but that's not what I get back? How do I meet that? So many of you know that I find great solace in poetry, and I bring poems into every single class, every single time that we meet, because I think that art, as any form of art, artistic expression, helps us name what might feel unnameable. At least that's how I experience it. And so I want to bring in some other artists today, other poets today that are helping me this week name and be with the truth of our world. So this first poem is called Mimesis. And mimesis is what it means is imitation or mimicry, a representation or imitation of the real world through art. So mimesis. And this poem is by Fadi Judah. He's a Palestinian-American poet and physician. And this is the poem. My daughter wouldn't hurt a spider that had nested between her bicycle handles for 2 weeks. She waited until it left of its own accord. If you tear down the web, I said, it'll simply know this isn't a place to call home and you'd get to go biking. She said, that's how others become refugees, isn't it? Let me read that to you again. Mimesis. My daughter wouldn't hurt a spider that had nested between her bicycle handles for 2 weeks. She waited until it left of its own accord. If you tear down the web, I said, it'll simply know this isn't a place to call home and you'd get to go biking. She said, that's how others become refugees, isn't it? Amazing, isn't that? What are the things that we take for granted? How do we take up space? What do we do that we think is to our own benefit, that another's life doesn't matter? We can just wipe it out and go biking. So as I'm talking with you about this, I can feel my own heart beating a little bit. More obviously, I can feel a sensation in my own body that I get in the presence of fear and deep unrest. Kind of feels like I'm standing at the edge of a cliff. I get rubber body. And I wonder how you are today. I'm going to talk a lot more. It's true. The suffering is true for all of us. And I don't think there's an easy answer to this. That's the Four Noble Truths, that life includes suffering and we tend to make it worse, but we don't have to. And this is the pith of the practice, is how am I not going to make it worse? How do I meet my own heart and my own suffering? Because your own suffering, my own suffering is true. It's real. And this collective suffering that we have right now is overwhelming. We're going to talk about the nervous system in a couple of minutes, but the overwhelm of it is true. And that's also part of why being in the body, to the extent that one can, is critically important. Sylvia, do you have anything that you would like to add here?
No, this was the best place for me to be today.
Okay.
I'm really very touched by your teaching and by people's responses. And just, again, with the solace that I feel to be in community with people that I know care about, think the same way I do, and really whose view, as is mine, is wishing well for all beings everywhere, without unbounded, really, without categories, all beings everywhere.
It is a protection, isn't it?
It is a protection. I'll just say this. On the day after the 9/11 attack in 2001, the day of that day that it happened was a Tuesday, and the following day was a Wednesday, and more people came to Spirit Rock that morning than normally, and just like today is the day after horrific news. And people came, I think, because they wanted just to be in community and be able to. And one of the things we did was we communally shared, as we're sharing now, where were you? Who do you know who's directly involved? How are you? And in that morning, we all recited refuges and precepts to be able to say, no matter what's going on and how provocative it is for me to respond impulsively, that I undertake the vow to abstain from harming living beings, and have us all say it together, was the most soothing thing, mm-hmm. was the most uplifting thing that day. And I can't stay all of this morning, but I wanted to be here because I wanted to be in community where I know that that's already a given. This is a community of people that feel as I do, that we could all care about everyone. May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. It's not just a beautiful phrase. It's actually the expression of deep wisdom and ultimate compassion.
Yeah, ultimate compassion. I'm so glad that you're here. Thank you. Let's talk about the nervous system a little bit, because this is going to point to the sense of overwhelm that you may or may not be feeling. And if this doesn't apply to you right now, it will apply to you some other time. And if your hand is raised, if we don't get to your question right now, we will before the end of the time today. But I want to talk about specifically what is happening in this nervous system, and this practice of rightness and wrongness. So let's start with this. When you feel right, what does it feel like in your body? Just sense in and go to that experience of being right. And let's use the chat. And type in, if you will, what does it feel like to be right? Because we can get more people's response than waiting for everybody to unmute. So let's just type this in. What does it feel like to be right? If you wouldn't mind. Free. Okay. Tightly constricted, solid. Keep it coming. This is good. At peace. It doesn't matter in the USA. What does it feel like in the body? Unbendable. Okay, so you get the point, right? There's some uplifted, rigid. I feel shiny, clear, open, humorous, aware, excitement. Great. All right, now it's opposite. What does it feel like in the body? This is really the key question here. What does it feel like in the body to be wrong? Sense it. What does it feel like? Settled. Contraction. Weak. Shameful. Nausea. Heavy. A stone in my chest. Sad. Depressed. Out of control. Small. This is great. Painful. Yeah. Stuck. Okay. Thank you. So cramped. Very different sensations when one feels right and one feels wrong, isn't it? I know for me, when I feel that righteousness, there's like this, that tightness. I feel tight. I feel constricted. I feel that rigidity. And when I'm wrong, I feel softer. Shame might come up, maybe embarrassment, maybe humility, but not so much, humiliation, not so much anymore. So, you know, when the Buddha taught about mindfulness of the mind, a mind that is open and a mind that is constricted, or in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, and in the expert's mind, there are few. When we have an open, curious, gentle disposition, we can be right or wrong and it doesn't matter. That's where we learn. We learn from this open, soft place, and we have a conditioning that says to be right is good and to be wrong is bad or shameful. That's what we need to get rid of. It's not about right and wrong, because out of the rightness and the wrongness comes the war, comes the fighting, comes the suffering. What if we can let go of our need to be right or our shame in being wrong? Because where we learn is in the softness. I don't learn anything when I'm right, when I'm in a righteous place. But when I don't understand something and I'm willing to say, I don't get it, I don't know, that's where all the possibility is. But in order to be in that place, I need to have a more regulated nervous system. And I also need this practice, actually. This practice of clarity and kindness and a commitment to not causing harm to myself or anybody else. So let's talk about the brain a little bit and what is happening in the nervous system. So this is something that I learned from Dan Siegel, who is a psychiatrist and well-known writer, researcher at UCLA. And this is called the hand model of the brain. Anybody familiar with the hand model of the brain? Good, Victoria is good, I'm glad. All right, so here's what it looks like, and Nancy is. So you take your forearm and imagine that your whole forearm here is your spine. And then you come up into the wrist, and this is where the spinal cord comes up into the wrist, way back here. And then here in the palm of the hand is your brainstem. It comes right where the spine comes into the base of the brain. But here is the brainstem, the deepest, oldest part of the brain. It takes in information from the body. It's where the autonomic nervous system lies, the things that are involuntary, breathing, circulation, respiration, digestion. And it's connected to the limbic system. And so if you take your thumb and stick your thumb on the palm, the limbic system is the emotional meaning arousal center, the amygdala. It's that which is looking out for danger, where that starts to secrete acetylcholine and cortisol, fight flight sorts of hormones, stress hormones. So here's the limbic system. It comes into the center of the brainstem, the deepest part of the brain. And then fingers come over the top, and this is the cortex. It regulates the other parts of the brain, thinking, thoughts, mapping of experience, it starts to put all the other things together, all these parts of the brain starts to integrate them. And then on the fingernails here, this is the prefrontal cortex, the places where our higher thinking occurs and the capacity to integrate experience. So when we're activated, startled, frightened, triggered, whatever word you want to use that works for you, by fear, by, you know, whatever it is that brings up this stress, there's increased activity in the limbic system way down here, deep in the brain, which can override as it starts pouring out cortisol and acetylcholine and these stress hormones. It starts to override the cortex and blocks the connections to the prefrontal cortex. And what happens is we get into that fight, flight, freeze mode. And when it's intensified like that, what happens, what Dan Siegel says, is boom, we can flip our lid. To flip our lid is when these different aspects of the brain, and I gave such a rudimentary example, because if you are a scientist, you know that this is like so simplified. But when this happens, the different parts of our brain that are necessary to interact with each other become disintegrated. They are dysregulated. And if you've had an experience of overwhelm, or maybe feeling like, I can't even think, I have to go do something else, or you have a child who's having a meltdown and they say, I can't think. Well, it's true. We actually can't, because we don't literally have access to the higher thinking capacity of the mind until it settles down and starts to reintegrate. Is this making sense? This is very helpful to me because I understand what is happening deep in my body and deep in my brain. So our practice is a continual practice of deepening and integrating our whole nervous system. And the nervous system is hardly only in the brain, right? The nervous system is throughout the entire body, which is why I know that when I have overwhelm or deep fear, I get that sense in my body of standing at the edge of a cliff and I get rubber body, because my nervous system is everywhere. It's in every single cell of our bodies. And interestingly, one of the pieces of research that Dan Siegel has come up with is that the best predictor of our well-being is the degree to which the various aspects of the brain are connected to and working with each other. The level of integration of the different aspects of the brain is a good predictor of our well-being, which supports why we do this practice. Because we do know, I hope you have really found out in all of your years of practice, even if it's not a lot of practice, there's something that brings you back over and over again that oftentimes you feel like, oh, I just feel better. Maybe we can't name it why I feel better, but sitting quietly, steadying the mind, tending to the heart, meeting ourselves exactly as we are, is a process of integration. It's a process of deep self-acceptance and love, ultimately. So we need these practices of pausing and stopping. You know, STOP is a fantastic acronym that we can all keep in our back pocket or on the mirror. When we're activated, when we're frightened, when we're startled, and maybe to the degree that we're going to say or do something that we prefer that we wouldn't have done, use this practice of STOP. S is for stop. Like literally stop what you're doing. T, take a breath. Tune in. The tuning in brings us into the experience of what's happening in my heart, what's happening in my body. The O is open and observe. Oh, I'm frightened. Oh, I'm angry. Anger is here. I feel so much anger. I feel so much confusion. So we start naming it. The stopping is doing something. Taking a breath, right? Really helps regulate and soothe. Open, observe. Oh, this is what's happening. And when you're ready, proceed. And if you're not ready, pause. stop, tune in, take a breath, open, observe, pause, and then proceed. That is what our practice is training us to do. Because when we do that, we are so much less likely to cause any harm. We're already in a really difficult world. And the only thing we have control of is what we do. Really, it's what we do. We can't control what floats through our minds. We can't control the emotions that arise because we're alive beings. But we can train in proper response, in loving response. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh describes mindfulness as allowing us to look deeply and see what's going on. That's what it is. It means seeing and knowing what's going on, and that's not so easy. To see and know what's going on takes training, takes courage, takes openness, willingness, gentleness. So here's a poem from Yehuda Amichai, who is an Israeli poet. It's called The Place Where We Are Right. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are right is hard and trampled like a yard. But doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, a plow. And a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. So when we're right, nothing can grow. But when we soften, a little bit, that's when the dandelion makes its way through the cracks. That's the ultimately where that line that says, and a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. That's the what else is true? What are the other possibilities? And dare I say, even to a place ultimately of forgiveness of ourselves and others for all of our confusions and the ways we hurt ourselves and each other. So this way of experiencing rightness and wrongness and overwhelm and having some understanding of what's happening in the body is critically important. Pausing, stopping, waiting. Another acronym on wait. What am I thinking? All right, how often do we just fly through things and we don't pause to say, wait a minute, what am I thinking here? And then I remember years ago, Sylvia saying with wait, why am I talking? Why am I talking? Stop, wait, 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 stop, wait, stop, wait. You know, you can use that, and I know I'm making a little bit of a joke, but none of this is a joke at all. We must stop. We must wait. We must sense in and act for the good. And don't participate in harm, in overt acts of harm. Don't wish ill upon another, because that will rot our hearts for sure and poison our minds. All right, so let's move into a sit. So find a posture that works well in your body. And again, this is up to you. This is up to you to choose the best place, the best posture for you. Supporting yourself with the furniture, the floor. No forcing. Remembering struggle is extra. Just being here. Again, sensing the body and the posture it's in. Letting the breath come and go. Meeting the heart exactly as it is. And approaching this meditation with a quality of kindness, friendliness and love, being here in this body at this time. Listening in. Letting yourself, to the degree that you can, listen to the wisdom of this body and this heart. What wants to be known, what is showing itself. Not digging around for anything that isn't showing itself, just being here and listening in. And through cultivating this presence of mind and heart and body, returning over and over again. When the mind goes somewhere else, come back and begin again, returning here. With the quality of sadha, faith, trust, confidence, you can take the next breath. We can do this together. Trusting this path of practice, of clear seeing, of kindness, of wisdom, and non-harming. And through this orientation towards kindness and being here and listening and returning and trusting, resting in the Sangha, maybe even a little gratitude, like some have said, just to be here because it's the place to be today. And if you like, you can repeat these phrases quietly to yourself. I take refuge in the Buddha. I can rest in and rely upon my own wisdom, my own true north that is supported by all the wisdom teachers before us, the Buddha himself, our elders, our mentors, all that we've learned to take refuge in the Buddha. To take refuge in the Dharma, the truth of impermanence, of everything changing always, the nature of difficulty and pain and suffering, the dukkha, that this is included in a life, and that everything is connected to everything else, and that we are connected to one another. Taking refuge in the reality of how things are, what the Buddha taught. I take refuge in this beautiful Sangha, community of beings where awakening can happen. All the ways we rely upon each other to support our hearts and minds, our ability to be in this life. And from the foundation of the refuge that the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha actually reliably offer, we step into the practices of non-harming, dedicating our lives, aligning our lives with these practices of not causing harm, to undertake a training to help us take care of ourselves and each other. We undertake the training to not intentionally harm life, but to honor and support our own life and the lives of others. We undertake the training not to take anything from anyone or anywhere that hasn't been freely offered. Instead, we train in generosity, in offering ourselves, our presence, our resources, our capacity to be generous in whatever way that shows up for you, to share our lives. We undertake the training to not use our language in any way that causes harm to ourselves or others. We train in speaking kindly and gently, in a way that is helpful and at the right time. We speak with restraint and decisiveness and love. We undertake a training to never use sexuality to harm ourselves or anybody else. But to be safe in ourselves, to offer safety to others, to care for our bodies deeply, to honor the bodies of others. We undertake a training of clarity and simplicity, not using substances that cloud the mind, whatever those substances or habits might be, noticing habits of all kinds of consumption, and being moderate. And we do all of this so we can take good care of ourselves and each other. The clear mind knows what to do, can hear the heart. And the heart connected to the clear mind, this open, kind heart connected to a clear mind, makes good choices and is part of the mesh of our lives that is here for the good, does not hurt, but learns to love. Let's sit quietly. in this quiet space. See if you notice anywhere in the body that feels at ease. Resting, comfortable, maybe even a little pleasant. And let the mind explore what that ease actually feels like in the body, if you can. Maybe it's a place that is open or soft, maybe a little bit warm or cool. Maybe it's entirely neutral, doesn't really feel like anything. But it's not a problem. It's actually a place that can be a refuge in the body itself, a place that is simply comfortable and at ease, maybe with a quality of feeling like home. Let yourself be there, in that place in the body. Maybe even imagine breathing in and out of that space. Resting, resting in the body. It doesn't need to be a big space. It could be the tip of the nose, a fingernail even. Resting the mind there. And then if it feels available to you, letting that quality of ease in the body, wherever you feel it, let it spread. Invite it to move just as water follows the path of least resistance. Can this quiet, easeful stillness in the body spread through the body? Down the legs and the arms. Filling the torso and the neck and the head. All the way out to the edges of the body. And maybe even beyond. Surrounding you with ease and quiet. Rest, a place that can contain everything. You can make that sphere around you as big as you want. This is a poem called Wage Peace by Judith Hill. Wage peace with your breath. Breathe in firemen and rubble. Breathe out whole buildings and flocks of red-winged blackbirds. Breathe in terrorists and breathe out sleeping children and freshly mown fields. Breathe in confusion. Breathe out maple trees. Breathe in the fallen and breathe out lifelong friendships intact. Wage peace with your listening, hearing sirens, pray loud. Remember your tools, flower seeds, clothespins, clean rivers. Make soup. Play music. Memorize the words for thank you in three languages. Learn to knit and make a hat. Think of chaos as dancing raspberries. Imagine grief as the outbreath of beauty or the gesture of fish. Swim for the other side. Wage peace. Never has the world seemed so fresh and precious. Have a cup of tea and rejoice. Act as if armistice has already arrived. Celebrate today. Practice of Tonglen, breathing in the pain and breathing out goodness, breathing out the prayer that suffering ends. Bringing in your own metta practice now. Offering your own metta for anyone, including yourself, in this quiet interior space. Let's take 5 minutes and come back. Thank you. Okay, welcome back, everybody. Thank you for coming back. I'm glad you did. So let's talk about intention and why intention is so critically important. You know, I've told you the story before that I'll tell again that I think is extremely useful. It's a story that Tara Brach tells about having been on a panel with five other Dharma teachers. She was the only woman, and each person had 10 minutes to talk about what was really important to them about the Dharma and what was the key to our practice. And she was preceded by Roshi Richard Baker, who was a pretty revered teacher in San Francisco Zen Center. And she was going second in this panel discussion, and he went up to the podium and he was in all of his formal Zen robes and he put his hands together and he said, "The key to freedom is intention and attention." And he bowed and he walked off the stage. And she thought, oh my God, he was supposed to talk for 10 minutes. And she said that what she wanted to do was go up there and say, like he said. And that was going to be her whole talk. Yeah, just like he said, the key to freedom is intention and attention. And so I bring that in again because I think about it a lot. What is my intention? Where am I placing my attention? And then adding to that, what is the orientation of my heart? What is the attitude of my heart? Am I coming from goodwill or do I have a grump going on? And is my mind and heart clouded a little bit? Because we all get a grump going on sometimes. So that brings us to this very important factor of the Eightfold Path, which is wise intention. Or when the Buddha said, what, when I do it, will be for the welfare and happiness of both myself and others. That takes us right into the depth of an intention question. It's a compass question, right? When you think about orienting or calibrating, more like, let's talk about calibration, calibrating the inner compass. And this can be really hard. And right now we are really challenged to keep our compass calibrated towards goodness, to not get off track and to get caught in the extremes of ill will, in the overwhelm and outrage and pain of what's happening. Because there's overwhelm related to the ill will and outrage of what is happening forever. And right now it's very, very, very high, very, very dangerous. But we must come back to intention, skillful intention. So it's made up of three components. This is all from Buddhist perspective as the second factor on the Eightfold Path. So for those who may not know, the Eightfold Path is what the Buddha gave in response to how do we deal with the truth of suffering. It's the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. The first is that life includes suffering. The second is that there's a cause of our suffering, which is our greed and ill will, our holding on to things, insisting they be a certain way when they're other. That peace is possible. There can be an end of suffering. And I relate to that as momentary, not like all the suffering is going to end for all time, but that because what I have control of is what I do, I can manage through my actions the degree to which I suffer. But we need a way to do this. And so the fourth of these Four Noble Truths is, and here is the path leading to the end of suffering. And it's the Noble Eightfold Path, which is very well laid out. You can find it, but we'll talk today about this second path factor, which is wise intention, which is comprised of three important components. The first is renunciation, or letting go, simplicity. So, you know, sometimes the word renunciation can be activating for some people who think of it in certain ways, and it can feel like a self-denigration, self-suffering. What am I going to have to renounce this or that? But can I let go of that which causes me suffering? That's renunciation. A letting go is simplicity versus the greedy, the graspy, the clinging, the sticky desires. So that's a really important piece of wise intention. The second is loving kindness, non-ill will, friendliness, wishing well for others and ourselves versus hatred, right? Versus aversion, versus all the ways, all the permutations of ill will. Because it isn't wise intention if one has the intention to cause harm. That might be the intention, but it is not wholesome, it is not skillful, it is not wise, that's perfectly obvious. And the third is compassion. Compassion must be a component of our intentions, this desire to respond in a loving way versus cruelty, even indifference, harmfulness. And sometimes, you know, we can confuse what indifference is with neutrality, not taking sides. That's different. Indifference is missing, I think, a quality of care. So when we talk about loving kindness, metta, and compassion, and we can talk about all four of the primary heart practices of metta and compassion and mudita, appreciative joy, and equanimity. Just as a little bit of an aside, it's said that with metta, with loving kindness, the heart loves. With compassion, the heart responds. With appreciative joy, the heart delights. And with equanimity, the heart allows. So these are components that have to be woven into wise intention. So if we talk about the first, renunciation and simplicity, This is this quality of restraint and discipline. Can we wait and see? And this is how we come back to this piece of pausing, right? That when we are frightened, startled, overwhelmed, to not act out of that place, but to wait until the mind and the heart have settled a little bit. You know, the shaken up snow globe. And that's how it can feel. But if we wait till the clarity comes back, chances are really good that we're going to behave in a really skillful way. So we wait and see. And oftentimes, you know, there's this expression that is very common that says, oh, just let go. Just let go. And we can't always do that, right? Like we would if we could. It's not so easy. But can we let things be? And I think this is much more skillful when we can't let something go because we have a negativity bias, because we might have strong feelings about something. Maybe we've really been harmed. And we don't just let it go, but we learn to work with it. Can we let it be? And oftentimes in the letting things be, we can see how that phrase that says, all hindrances are self-liberating in the great space of awareness. All hindrances. Now we could talk about the hindrances classically, but all things that get in the way of seeing clearly, when we let them be, in the great space of awareness, it is a great space of awareness. They often dissolve. They often settle down. Have you ever noticed that? If we just let it alone for a little bit. And back to what Jane said earlier, I feel sad. I don't know what to do about it. We don't have to do anything about it. When we can let things be, that is a practice of compassion. It is a practice of metta. It's a practice of letting go, of simplicity. This is how it is right now. It's a profound turning towards the truth of what is here. We can ask ourselves questions like, why am I doing what I'm doing? Right? This is back to the stop and pause practice. What am I thinking? Why am I doing this? And, you know, we can say, why am I talking? Which we can make a joke out of because it's funny, but I'm not being funny about it now. Why am I doing what I'm doing? What, toward what end? Can we let go of, if we take the practice of renunciation very, very literally, what are the things we can let go of? Material things, stuff. Can we let go of relationships that no longer work? And that's painful. That's really hard. This is part of the practice. What happens when somebody lets go of us? If you've ever had a really long friendship and then sort of doesn't work anymore, but you didn't realize it until the other person says, you know, it's not really working for me. Or they don't say it, they just sort of leave. That's happened for many of us. We can be on both sides of that. Views, right? Suspending loyalty to our own opinions long enough to say what else might be true. That's a renunciation practice. Hard work, really hard work. Fears. Hard to let go of fears because it's a scary world. These are all practices around wise intention. And I'm not saying let go of your fears. What I'm saying is that we bring awareness to whatever is happening. And sometimes the fear is, well, fear is often about the future. It's usually not about right this minute. But I think in clarity of vision, in seeing things more clearly, I'll just use a sort of a silly example of seeing things clearly. There's a classic story of the fear that arises when you see the snake coiled out in the yard, and you don't know what to do about this snake that's out sleeping, coiled up in the yard. So you very gingerly go out there and see if you can get it to go. And walk around it until you get close enough to see that it's the coiled up hose, the coiled up garden hose that's out in the yard. It's not a snake at all. So what is it that we think we see that's actually inaccurate? that creates a lot of suffering. And this is where these practices of inquiry come in. What is really happening? So the practice of renunciation and simplicity of letting be is inherently a practice of generosity, because it's softer, it's kinder, it opens, it says, what else can be here? What can I release? And it gives us insights into how greed and hatred and delusion work. We get freedom. We get freed up from encumbrances by not holding tightly to any one thing or view. But this is not easy. Where do we get caught? Desire is sticky. Views are sticky. Letting go, letting be is hard. And this is why it's one of these path factors, because it's not something that's so simple. We need to keep working it and working it. Terry Tempest Williams, a beautiful writer, she says, if we are to flourish as a species, an erosion of belief will be necessary that says we are not the center of the universe, but a dynamic part on an expanding and contracting future that celebrates and collaborates with uncertainty. Isn't that true? And we often hold on because life is uncertain. And if I can just hang on to it like this right now, maybe I'll have a little bit of security. But to understand that to flourish, we need an erosion of belief. So what are these fixed views that are causing these wars that have created what happened a few days ago? The indoctrination of evil, basically, that trains people's minds in a certain way that causes unbelievable harm. We have to be willing to look at that. So this practice of renunciation is part of wise intention. This next aspect, loving kindness, metta, non-ill will, the true wish for ourselves and others to be well, to be happy. It's friendliness, it's warm-heartedness. My very, very favorite translation of metta comes from John Peacock. He's a Pali scholar, British teacher. He says that metta actually means to grow fat with friendliness. Isn't that beautiful? To grow fat with friendliness. I'd like to do that. I'd really like to train in that. Turning the heart to warm. Imagine the heart as a thermostat. Can we train in turning it to warm and acting out of that place? How different would our world be? Softening that which is rigid in the heart. The Dalai Lama says that this practice of metta is a practice of internal disarmament. Internal disarmament. How are we armed? How are the places in us that are the most beautiful covered over? And how can we reconnect with them? We do it through all of these different kinds of practices. Andrea Gibson, beautiful poet, in her little poem called All the Good in You. When all the good in you starts arguing with all the bad in you about who you really are, never let the bad in you make the better case. Isn't that beautiful? When all the good in you starts arguing with all the bad in you about who you really are, never let the bad in you make the better case. Because we strengthen what we pay attention to. And we all have parts of ourselves that we reject. And we all have the ability to act badly. And this is why we are in practices that help us cultivate all of these, all of the love, the non-harming, to see clearly. So when the inner critic starts having the louder voice, we tame that. Say, no, 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 I'm not feeding into that. And, you know, when we blow it and we act in a way that isn't our best, we make amends, we change, we fix it. But don't believe the voice inside of you that says you're not worthy, that says you're not good. that says you don't belong. You don't let that make the better case. And compassion, the third aspect of wise intention, the ability to say, how can I help? To respond, the heart that responds in the way that makes sense for you, for me. This is my very, very favorite description of compassion. It comes from Dr. Rachel Naomi Raymond. Compassion begins with the acceptance of what is most human in ourselves, doesn't it? It starts with the compassion, the acceptance of what is most human and vulnerable in myself, what is most capable of suffering, in attending to our own ability to suffer. We can uncover a profound and simple connection between our own vulnerability and the vulnerability in all others. That is what brings out the instinct of kindness. So look at the vulnerabilities that we are seeing in every side of every war, every argument. Everybody is vulnerable. Everybody is scared and suffering and in pain and wants to be okay and to be safe and to be loved and not to be harmed based on all the reasons people are harmed. So I know when my vulnerability meets your vulnerability, we're not going to hurt each other. Because what we're really doing is saying what we both want is to be loved and to be okay. And I will take care of you and you will take care of me when we really see that in each other. Pema Chodron said, if we begin to get in touch with whatever we feel with some kind of kindness, our protective shells will melt and we'll find that more areas of our lives are workable. That's actually where we start, right? Can we let it melt a little bit and just find areas of our lives that begin to be more workable? We can't do all of it all at once, but it's areas of our lives. And when one thing becomes a little easier, a little more workable, it shows us what we can do. And those parts support the other parts that then can actually become more workable. So as a practice, we need to sit down and get to know our own minds and our own hearts, the connection between what we think, what we feel, what we say, what we do, our habits. And it begins with intention. You know that beautiful invocation to many of the Buddhist texts that says, O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember who you are. The clarity of mind, the goodness of heart, trust it, return to it. It is home. This is the intention practice. We start from the goodness of who we are, and we go from there. All right, everybody. I really appreciate your courage, your bravery, your showing up. May all beings truly know peace. Thank you, everybody. Okay. Bye, everyone.